Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3 and it is final draft time. Books, writing and literary culture every Saturday morning. My name is Andrew Popel. Have you been enjoying the Final Draft podcast? We launched only a week and a half ago, and as a special introductory treat, we've been dropping an episode a day all week. That is more books for you more often. There is one coming today, completely separate to this show. There's going to be one tomorrow. And I just want you to get the best of Australian writing. And to that end, I've got two fantastic pieces of work for you today. Sally Piper's The Geography of Friendship. This is an amazing psychological thriller. I've likened it to horror. As three friends go hiking at the end of high school to cement their friendship and find themselves followed and tormented by a mysterious, invisible stranger. You have to catch this conversation because it has so much to say about the culture of toxic masculinity and violence against women that occupies our news and is really, it's absolutely horrific. Later on in the show, I have a special conversation brought to us by Anthony Dockrell, 2SER's program director. Anthony is in conversation with journalist Catherine Murphy, discussing her essay On Disruption. Do you find yourself swamped by media? Are you having trouble finding the time to just read a novel? That is because in the new digital era, we're on call 24/7. Our phones are never far from our hands. And it changes the way not only that we consume, but the way those stories are told. So, look, stick around because Anthony has a fantastic insight with Catherine on exactly that topic. This is Final Draft and we have got the books, the writing, the literary culture, and it's all coming up just after this short break.
David Dungay Jr. died in Long Bay Jail after he refused to stop eating a packet of biscuits.
On the morning of December 29th, 2015, corrective service officers stormed the Dungay man's cell.
I'm Taylor Fuller.
I am Miles Herbert, and this is Breathless, the death of David Dungay Jr.
From Guardian Australia and 2SER 107.3, the Dungay family's journey for justice.
Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're on Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm joined on the line by Sally Piper. Sally's debut novel was 2014's Grace's Table, and today she's joining me to discuss her latest, The Geography of Friendship. Sally, welcome.
Thank you, Andrew, and thanks for having me on your show today.
Oh, look, it's exciting. I'm very interested to talk about The Geography of Friendship. Samantha, Lisa, and Nicole are drawn together at school, and individually, they do not feel a place in any of the cliques and the social circles that make up the topography of adolescent relationships. And this makes them stronger in their friendship because they've chosen each other. And following high school, they embark on a five-day hike. Now, the experience is meant to help them discover themselves and bond in nature. That is, until a chance encounter with a male hiker spirals them into a horrific torment, stalked on the trail and harried throughout the dark nights. Now in their 40s, the women meet again after almost 25 years, treading the same trail of their youth and seeing if they can make sense of those lost days. And so just wow, Sally, there is so much in this book to discuss. Where to begin? Now, actually, I understand that you took on a similar trek to the one that you describe in The Geography of Friendship, although I hope without the torment.
Yeah, I did, Andrew. It's interesting where the story is loosely set, and it is loosely set, is Wilson's Promontory in Victoria. And that's an area where I grew up, and that's an area where I first started bushwalking as a very tiny little girl on legs barely long enough to keep up with my older siblings. But when it came to set this as the scene for the novel, all I could think of Wilson's Promontory with a sense of nostalgia and of this beautiful idyllic area that I grew up in, and I couldn't think of it as being a sinister place, and it needed to be a sinister place. And so that's when I decided, right, I need to do this walk. I need to walk where these women are going to walk and do it on my own and experience this hardship, not just of the terrain, but also that sense of isolation that they experience on their five-day hike. So got the big pack on and away I went.
I have a feeling as our discussion continues that we are actually going to explore the fact that the violence that you describe shows us how any place can become a sinister place. But I want to, before we get to that, though, I want to think about the friendship between Lisa, Nicole and Samantha. It's central to the book. What was important to you in bringing these three together?
I really wanted to look at three women, young women, who meet at school as adolescents, which in that short time for female friendships then, where often friendships are forged in sameness. So the girls who are all the same are the ones that gel together, and those girls who are seen to be a bit different, who aren't the sporty girl or the pretty girl or the skinny girl back when these women were young, were the ones who are often outcast and often cruelly. So these three girls come together because they're all different. Lisa, she's an angry girl at times and she's a fighter. You've got Lisa, you've got Samantha, who's a peacekeeper, and you've got Nicole, who follows the rules. And so not only are they physically different from one another, but they're also emotionally different. But that is what unified them in the end and made their friendship so strong, is because they weren't conforming to what everyone else thought they should be or what they should look like.
Yeah, and a part of that sense of themselves as individuals is that need to discover more of themselves, and that's what takes them on this five-day hike. Now, we have a tradition of horror across American and British and Australian film that we're saturated with, and it sort of shows us this faceless antagonist who preys on the victim. And in your book, I could even see a younger reader catching some of the novel's confrontations in the language of jump scares, which is very much that sort of gaming side of horror that's really huge at the moment. In the book, you made me reevaluate this visual language of horror as being particularly gendered. It's probably, you know, a bit of a no-brain moment to think one of these horror protagonists are often male. Did you have horror on your mind as you wrote The Geography of Friendship?
You know, I didn't intend to write a horror story, and I don't actually think it is a horror story. It was fear. I wanted to explore fear in women, but I also wanted to explore our perceptions of fear, because the male character, who's never named in the novel, he's just the man, and he's intentionally quite a sparse character, and we really don't ever see him apart from the first altercation that they have in the car park at the trailhead with him. The girls don't actually see him again for several days, and each of them almost in their own way thinks of him as either phantom-like or not. Well, Lisa, certainly the angry character, she just can't really even perceive that he's a reality on many levels and doesn't believe that he's out there and he's a threat to them that he proves to be. But it was quite intentional that I made his character sparse, because I wanted to sort of explore this idea that women build boogeymen in their minds. We build fear in our minds, and we live with that every single day, as we've found with all the media, especially recently, that we alter the things we do and where we go and what we wear and what we say to conform to this expectation that we don't go to certain places or do certain things. But then we live with this constant fear as a consequence, and that's what I really wanted to explore in this. One of the many things is this sense of fear that we as women live with on a daily basis.
You had me thinking about that, this idea. I mean, violence against women is really a horror story of our time, and the perpetrators aren't masked villains. I mean, I guess the difference between horror as it plays out in, I guess, contemporary popular narratives is that there is no supernatural masked villain who is perpetrating the horror. It's very ordinary people, and so often there's this sort of apologist sense of the media talking about understanding the person who perpetrates these acts as they were a nice person and the like. Was that juxtaposition of ordinariness with the evil important here?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he was to be perceived as the everyman or the any man. He's the thing we fear in our dreams or in our imagination. And he's quite faceless in that regard, but it's not a major physical presence. And so, no, he wasn't. I didn't want people to be able to just see an individual clearly. I wanted them to look at the the scope to which we allow ourselves to be afraid, I guess. And whilst he is something to fear, I also, as a solo bushwalker, I push against that boundary that says that I should be afraid all the time and everywhere that I go, because I don't want to have my life dictated by living in the fear that something could potentially happen, I guess, even though for these women something does happen.
And that's important, isn't it? The idea that he was quite ordinary, he was quite faceless. It could be anyone. And there is a moment in the book, and I forget which character is musing on this. I think it's Lisa struggling to maybe place some sort of mental anguish on this person, or maybe in some way that they're deranged and that's driven him to these acts, because that at least might help them understand. But in fact, he is completely ordinary, and he perpetrates this horror of tormenting the women simply because he can, it seems like. I mean, yeah. we never fully understand, but seemingly because he can.
And it's about the balance of power. He's almost, it's like, he treats it as a game, and what some of the characters do refer to it as this game that he plays. And it's about a power balance. He knew he could torment them, and he knew he could terrorise them, and he just looked for ways to do it, and that was what gave him pleasure. That was to be able to dominate over people in that way without necessarily being a physical domination over them. That isn't the great part of the story. It's a part of it, but not the only part of it. It's about this manipulation of women's thinking, and to have that power to do that, it's quite extraordinary, but it happens every single day.
So we have the twin journeys. We have the journey that play out in alternating points of view from each of the women, and across the initial journey where this torment's being perpetrated, and then the follow-up where they're drawn together. Well, they're not quite sure why, because Lisa brings them back together, but they all struggle with their reasons for taking on the hike. But on each journey, the women analyze feelings of blame and responsibility for the events of the hike. And when people talk about victim blaming, when people talk about gaslighting, these ideas that women are put through mental torment at the hands of men and to make them feel culpable in their own victimhood, their own terror, I think you've done a really good job of actually illustrating them for people that can't get their heads around it.
Yeah, that was really important to me, that you know, this whole ingrained belief that we're culpable in some way for things that happen against women. And you know, that's why it continues, and women aren't always able to leave those situations, is because this sense of self-blame that they have. And also the fact that these three women, that how their friendship disintegrates, there's an enormous amount of guilt that each of them carries with that event in itself, without all the other things that went on with the male character. So, you know, they've got this legacy that's followed right through their lives, because it's 24 years later before they go on the second hike, and they've all gone on and married, not all married, two of them have gone on to marry and have families, and the legacy of that hike that has infiltrated right throughout their lives and has never left them and has influenced the way they've lived that life ever since. You know, that is a powerful thing to have, and any experience that can dictate how you live your life forevermore. You know, that's an awful thing to have to carry with you, the burden of that. And that's one of the things that I was trying to explore, this sense of blame that we carry, or guilt and shame and humiliation that these women were subjected to, and the long-term consequences of that.
Thank you again to Sally Piper. We were discussing her novel, The Geography of Friendship. We are going to take a track right now, though, before coming back with Catherine Murphy's On Disruption. This is new from Fantastic Furniture. It's called Bad Timing.
Over time. make your vision come to life and train with the best at the National Institute of Dramatic Art. Pairing collaborative, practical training with valuable industry connections, NIDA offers studies in acting, musical theatre, costume, directing, production, makeup, design, scenic construction and more. Applications for Masters, Bachelor and Diploma courses are now open to start in 2019. Head to apply.nida.edu.au. NIDA sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture. We just took a track from Fantastic Furniture. That was called Bad Timing. And right now, I've got a very special conversation between 2SER's program director, Anthony Dockrell, and journalist Catherine Murphy. Catherine has recently penned an essay called On Disruption, looking at the explosion of digital media and really the fundamental shift in the way that we narrativize daily experience. And I guess consequently, the ways that we mediate our reality, how are stories told to us and how does that change the way we look at the world? Anthony and Catherine sat down for a conversation and they began with Catherine reflecting on the difference between the era of print journalism and our new digitalised now.
How are things different? Well, the simplest way of saying it, I think, or capturing it, is things were slower. The cycle moved more slowly, and our contributions to the sum of human knowledge as print journalists were rationed by technology. Basically, in 1996, if you were a print journalist, you filed often several stories a day. We worked quite hard. We felt we worked very hard then, several stories a day, which we filed in a great rush at the end of the evening. And the sub-editors and production folks put the newspaper together between when we filed at 8 o'clock and midnight. The papers were then obviously distributed out through the news agencies and they thudded on people's lawns every day as the sun came up. And so we were rationed basically in our contributions. We had one time of the day where we communicated with our readers. In those days, readers didn't talk back, but that's a whole other thing. We were rationed basically. We couldn't talk to readers all the time. We couldn't share information all the time. And that dynamic creates a different sort of news cycle than the one we see today.
What do you think we've lost?
The first thing to say is that it's not all lost. This little book of mine does dive deep and dystopian in places, but it's not all lost. We've also gained things, which I guess we.
So you see positives in all this disruption?
Am I positive?
Do you see positives in all this disruption?
I'm positive. Well, I'm mixed, is the truth. I'm not avoiding your question. Now, what have we lost, was the question you asked me. Well, I think we have lost some peace and quiet, some time for considered reflection, some steadiness in the public conversation, because now it's sort of, it flows at such a pace. And there are many, many voices all contributing in the public conversation. It can be difficult to hear yourself think sometimes. It can be difficult to settle on important topics and think about them in the news cycle that we exist in currently. I think that's the biggest loss, is some of that steadiness. And I think the loss of steadiness is certainly related to a loss in steadiness in political life as well. The changes have occurred simultaneously. I think what's occurred in the media, or the disruption in the media, has also been experienced slightly differently as disruption in politics as well. So we have lost. What we've gained, of course, is this explosion of content and information. News consumers have a variety of outlets they consume information from. They get news as it happens. That's an enormous public service, really, to keep a cadre of news consumers that informed all the time. And people I know, based on my own experience doing a lot of live reporting for both Fairfax and Guardian Australia, I know how big the audiences are for that content. People are are very keen to get their news now. That's obviously a public service.
Look, one of the interesting parts of your essay was that you place some of the blame for the coarsening of our politics at the feet of journalists.
Yep.
You know, from the constant need for fresh news, ever more conflict, the need for more and more clicks, which has fed back into the system and helped make the political landscape we now have. How aware do you think journalists are in their part in changing the system?
It's an interesting question because as a group, we're not hugely self-reflective characters. We're very focused on doing our jobs, getting out the news in all kinds of difficult circumstances. The professionally introspection is not particularly rewarded or encouraged. But I do think that we are aware, most of us are aware, that just by simple virtue of living this being lived experience for us, not an abstraction, something we have actually lived through ourselves, and we can understand what we used to do in the past and what we do now and the differences associated with those things. I think most journalists are self-aware about that. We do understand there's a connection between what we do and the impact that has had on politics and the strange feedback loop that creates. My concern in writing the little book was there's a lot of discussion about this, largely in academic circles, fantastic publications like the Columbia Journalism Review, for example. There's sort of lots of discussions of this at the margins, but there's not a lot of coalface reporting of what that change has actually felt like and the consequences of that change. And I did want to push myself to the nth degree with this project and ask the most difficult question a journalist can ask themselves, and that is, are we making this worse?
Well, look, in the meantime, look, you know, I follow a lot of journalists on Twitter, and you can't help but pick up that journalists are tired, exhausted, and jaded, working in this sort of working on this coalface. I mean, do you relate to this? And do you think that's also a real problem too, the burnout of this hyper news cycle that we're now in?
Burnout's a significant issue, both for practitioners and for readers. I think it's a danger at both ends.
Yep. As a reader, I remember the end of the Gillard years. I just wanted to check out and go away and never come back.
Yeah, well, it's a natural human response. And again, we have catch-22 on catch-22. News organisations are producing masses of content, much of it live, because that is what the audience wants. We know that because in the digital era, we know more about our audiences than we have ever known about them at any time in the history of journalism. So we know that's what the audience wants. We're flat out trying to deliver it to them. But at the same time, the amount of content, of course, that's being created and the intensification of the conflict cycle makes it sometimes quite unbearable to consume and listen to. We have to understand that that's a phenomenon. In terms of cynicism, which I think was sort of you at the nub of your point, journalists kind of burning out and becoming these wizened characters. Well, journalists are highly skeptical creatures. It does come with a territory. We're disinclined to take information on face value. I think that's true. I think if you're cynical, though, you're not adding much value either, to yourself or anyone else. I don't know. I'm struggling actually to think of any journalists that I know that are cynics, that are sort of misanthropes or cynics. I think a lot of us are idealists, really, in a strange way. It doesn't mean that we're perfect or quite the contrary, but it is an act of rampant idealism, journalism, in a way. You show up because you want to perform this public service. That's why you show up day after day.
Is that the
if you're a wizened person in your soul, I don't think you'd have the energy to keep showing up. Whether, though, that's, I suppose, an impression that gets created is an interesting question. That's an interesting question.
So for you, is it idealism that keeps you getting up each morning and going into work?
Well, I'm seriously... Sometimes people say, oh, you're so cynical. I'm really not. Not at all. And I still believe in the importance of what we do as journalists, the important role that we play in any democratic society, and I really value that. I really value living in a vibrant democracy where there's a lot of different voices, where culturally Australians, you know, don't take things too seriously, where there is this culture of, you know, standing up and having your say. I think that's what price can you put on that? That is just an enormous privilege. Of course it's a privilege, but it's hard. It's very hard, and we're obviously producing a lot of content with a lot fewer journalists. Again, I'm not sure whether people understand that, you know, we've had very large-scale job shedding in this industry. I mean, one stat that I quote in the book, in 2012, which was sort of really when the internet hit, 1,000 journalists went in that year alone, and the people who departed the industry, according to one long-term survey of departing or journalist redundees, the average age of the departures was 49, and there's people with 25 years experience on the job. So we've lost in this transition a lot of really great practitioners.
This is 2SER 107.3, and you're on Final Draft. We're almost at the end of the show. We have had fantastic conversations today. I want to say thank you to Sally Piper. We discussed her novel, The Geography of Friendship. And also, thank you very much to Anthony Dockrell, 2SER's program director, and his conversation with Catherine Murphy that we just listened to then, discussing On Disruption, our new digital media landscape and the way that it changes our consumption of media and, in turn, the way we narrativize, I guess, our own reality. Look, I've got to go. I have to say goodbye. You can get more Final Draft on the 2SER podcast. Just subscribe and get books in your ears every Monday on whatever device you want to listen to. The Vulture's Nest is coming up next, so don't go anywhere. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm going to be back next week. A bit of a preview. I have a fantastic collection of poetry. It is from Mariam Azam, and it is called The Hijab Files. I cannot wait to bring that to you next week on Final Draft. Till then, I'll see you later.